Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chew Man Chew, and I'm joined tonight by our producers, Dr. Callie Marshall and Dr. Jennifer Chisholm. Say hi, guys.
Hey.
Hi, happy to be here.
Tonight, we have a wonderful guest, Dr. Colleen Brennan, as we discuss specialty care in the newborn nursery. But first, Jennifer, do you want to remind us a little bit about the show?
Yes. So we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical polls, practice-changing knowledge, and answer lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Colleen Brennan. Dr. Brennan is an academic neonatologist who works at Washington University in St. Louis. She works in the Level 4 NICU at St. Louis Children's Hospital and as an assistant medical director in a Level 3 community NICU. Dr. Brennan is also the neonatal outreach director for the Washington University /BJC health system. In this episode, Dr. Brennan will teach us how to resuscitate a newborn and manage common complications like respiratory distress and hypoglycemia in the first few hours of life. Hey, Chris, how did the baby tell their mom they had a wet diaper?
I don't know.
They sent her a pee mail.
I love that.
I don't know, it's even funnier the way you said it. It was great.
Okay.
Oh, it's good. Hello, Dr. Brennan. Thanks for coming on the show. First, you know, we're sort of an informal group. Is it okay if I call you by your first name?
Please. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So, Colleen, introduce yourself to our audience. Could you give us a little bit about yourself and maybe something outside of medicine that you have fun doing?
Absolutely. So I'm a local St. Louisan. I'm very proud to work in St. Louis. I'm a wife and a mom of three kids. I have to shout out to my kids and my husband. My husband is Wes, and my kids are Luke, Laney, and Eddie. And I work as an academic neonatologist. And some of the things I love a good Diet Coke, good pizza, a trip to the beach. But we really lately have been enjoying our new MLS soccer team here in St. Louis. So my husband and I like to go to lots of St. Louis City soccer games. So that's kind of like our new fun date night these days. So that's my family. We're kind of a soccer family at the moment.
Nice. Are tickets pretty cheap these days?
They have done a really nice job with this franchise and made it much more affordable than other major league sports. But it's a hot ticket still in town, so it's competitive. Yeah.
Nice. That's yeah. Great. Callie, do you have any questions you want to ask?
Colleen, what is a book that every physician should read?
You know, I think that's such a funny question because I would say don't read anything about medicine. We have spent our lives reading things that we probably didn't want to read. And I would say pick something that allows you to escape medicine. You know, medicine can be pretty mundane. And so I would pick something completely recreational that makes you happy and helps you escape your job. So I don't have an actual title for you, but something that allows you to escape life a little bit. Yeah.
I love that.
Colleen, I have a question too. As a resident, I'm always sort of curious about the path of sort of faculty and attending. Could you share with me sort of what, as a trainee, you thought was the best advice that you received?
As a trainee, the best advice that I could offer is work hard, but be kind to yourself. I think a lot of us deny ourselves and put ourselves last on the list. And so I think for us to be able to function and be the best learner or the best resident, you have to allow yourself to thrive in other domains. So whether that's time with family, investing in hobbies, investing in your friendships. So that's probably as a learner, just trying to make sure all those domains in your life are fulfilled so that you continue to enjoy what you do. So that would probably be, as a learner, some of my best advice. And, you know, people often say, like, we should focus on progress and not perfection. None of us are going to be perfect at our jobs. None of us can show up every day and do everything perfectly. So work on the progress. And I think by being kind to yourself and developing friendships and interests outside of medicine is really important.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you for that.
Same. That's so encouraging. Do you have a favorite failure in something that potentially you learned from that?
A favorite failure is hard. I'm sure there's plenty of times that I have failed on different varying degrees. But one that I can remember as an intern was on the general pediatric ward. And I was helping to take care of a young adolescent boy who had overdosed on a medication that I don't remember what it was. But it was renally cleared. And I remember my senior resident said, keep this young man on IV fluids. This is how he's going to clear this drug. And I was like, yeah, no problem. I'll keep him on. And of course, that night, this teenage boy comes out and starts complaining that he's sick of going to the bathroom every hour. And I said, oh, that is annoying. Yeah, we could probably decrease the rate a little bit. And, you know, intern me was like, I think that's a kind thing to do. And little did I really think about it, but I was decreasing, you know, his drug clearance, and I was not actually helping him. And so it kind of reminds me that although that's not a huge failure, it delayed, you know, his discharge, a longer hospital stay. And even though something like that is inconvenient, it's necessary. And so I kind of learned that, you know, if I'm going to be a doctor, I have to step up and do things that are sometimes uncomfortable, and that all your decisions do matter. And if you're going to lead a team one day, not everyone's going to love your ideas. So that's like one that I can remember that the next morning my senior resident told me pretty point blank that I had not done a nice job. So that's kind of just a small example of something that you learn from. And I remember it, you know, I've been out of residency and fellowship for some time now. And it still like kind of hits me that that was dumb. So just thinking about medically, you're the doctor and your decisions, even though you think they may be kind or helpful to a family or a baby, you have to remember who you are in the care team.
So good, especially in pediatrics too. I feel like we really want to make people happy and kids and their families. And yeah, that's so true. Yeah.
And also as a resident, it's always really great when I hear someone senior share a dumb mistake they've made. Makes us all feel better.
I'm sure we all have many.
We all have many. That's one that, yeah, I just because I now work with that senior resident together.
Oh, gosh.
And we're really good friends. And it's just something that, you know, you carry with you and you're like, I won't make that dumb mistake again. So, yeah, it's true for every level of learning. You definitely have times where you have to reflect and get that constructive feedback.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure we all have enough stories to do a whole favorite failures podcast and just have it go on for ages. So
for sure.
Oh, definitely.
Who's ready to optimize their nutrition this year? Factor is here to help you, Cribsiders listeners. Factor has chef-made gourmet meals that make eating well easy. They're dietitian approved and ready to heat and eat in 2 minutes, so you can fuel right and feel great no matter what life throws at you. Whether it's too much time in the hospital or too little time between after-school activities, Factor will help you. Their meals arrive fresh and fully prepared, perfect for the busy lifestyle we all lead. With 40 options across 8 dietary preferences on the menu each week, it's easy to pick meals tailored to your goals. Choose from preferences like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, or Keto. At home, we use the vegan and veggie option and couldn't be happier. Eating vegetable forward has really helped us achieve our goals this last year. Factor can also help you feel your best all day long with wholesome smoothies, breakfasts, grab-and-go snacks, and more add-ons. So reach your goals this year with ingredients you can trust and convenience that can't be beat. Eat smart with Factor. Get started at factormeals.com/cribsiders50off and use code cribsiders50off to get 50% off your first box plus free shipping. That's code cribsiders50off at factormeals.com/cribsiders50off to get 50% off plus free shipping on your first box.
All right, should we move on to a case, guys?
Absolutely.
Let's do it.
Well, let me give you a case, Colleen, from Cassack Children. So you are an intern on your first day of labor and delivery, and your pager goes off. You are asked to report to the OR for a C-section. Mom is a G3P1 at 39 weeks, admitted for a scheduled repeat C-section. As you walk to the OR, you pull your laboring mom's list out of your frocket, which is a front pocket, and learn that mom's pregnancy is complicated by chronic hypertension, anxiety managed with fluoxetine, insulin-controlled gestational diabetes, and an estimated fetal weight in the 97th percentile. Serologies are unremarkable other than GBS positivity. You meet mom prior to the C-section and learn her baby girl will be named Poppy. C-section goes smoothly, but after 60 seconds of delayed cord clamping, Poppy has no respiratory effort and comes to the warming table. Can you share with us your first step in the management of a situation like this?
Absolutely. So this is a very common thing that we see. Callie knows this. Chris and Jennifer all know this too. So the most important thing I think that we have to recognize is this kid is apneic. This is neonatal apnea. And so the very first thing that you need to recognize is you need to provide positive pressure ventilation. Any baby who is apneic, has a heart rate that's less than 100, or is gasping and has kind of irregular respirations, we need to breathe for them. And in the neonatal world, that's positive pressure ventilation that is a mask that goes over their nose and mouth, ideally through a T-piece resuscitator, and we provide their ventilatory support. So just recognizing that is the biggest deal. Many trainees and nurses don't recognize the difference between when you need to help a baby breathe with positive pressure versus just applying a mask for CPAP. So we'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit, but identifying that indication for positive pressure is really important because this baby is asking for help. We commonly talk about those differences in positive pressure and CPAP, and I talked about those three indications for positive pressure. CPAP, when you place the mask over their nose and mouth and just provide a consistent pressure, or what we call PEEP, or positive end expiratory pressure, that is really only used for babies who are hypoxic, and that means not meeting their saturation goals for that minute of life, or they're having respiratory distress, and you're helping to support the inflation of their lungs with CPAP. So my first step is to always think about, how do I support this baby appropriately, and recognize when they're asking for positive pressure ventilation versus CPAP.
Can I roll it back just a little bit before this? So can you describe a little bit physiologically what happens at birth and how sort of respiration starts for this brand new baby, this neonate, and then maybe we can go into how this positive pressure might be useful for them afterwards?
Sure. So after a baby is born, most babies receive some delayed cord clamping if they look appropriate, meaning vigorous with appropriate tone. And after that umbilical cord is clamped, babies have to have their own spontaneous respiratory cycle and maintain a sufficient heart rate over 100. During this transition time to ex-utero life, or life away from mom, we think about several physiologic things that are happening in the heart and in the lungs, as we have to be responsible for our own circulation and breathing. One of those over time is a drop in the resistance of our lungs so that blood can leave the heart and go to the lungs appropriately for gas exchange. And another is in the heart, again, pumping blood to the lungs and allowing some physiologic changes and closing of fetal holes in the heart, which we call the patent foramen ovale, and slow constriction of the ductus arteriosus. So lots of changes are happening within the heart and lungs right after a baby is born. And the majority of babies, neonatal resuscitation says about 90% of babies do this really well. It's about 10% of normal, healthy term babies that need a little bit of help. And so that's why I have a job and why many of us study and think about this physiology, because there are many kids who need brief or transient support. And we have to think about what's going on in that heart and lungs.
Now, is there anything based on the history of the birth that increases the risk of seeing some of these issues, whether it's this was a C-section or some of the other comorbid issues that the mom had that makes you more concerned, or something that might make you more attentive to respirations for this baby after the born?
For sure. I think that's the main reason usually a pediatric resident or a pediatrician is called to these deliveries, when we know this is an OR case that has risk for complexity or resuscitation for a newborn. So after Callie read, this is a term baby, but mom is coming in for a scheduled C-section, so she has not gone through the normal spontaneous labor process that often helps babies secrete retained fetal lung fluid. So maternal epinephrine and steroid exposure, glucocorticoid exposure, when you're going into labor, increases and helps babies prepare for delivery. So in the setting of a scheduled C-section, this baby isn't quite prepared, as some would be, to transition to ex-utero life. Mom is on a medication called fluoxetine, which is an SSRI that can often make babies more predisposed to apnea after delivery. And also fluctuations in their tone. And then on top of that, mom has gestational diabetes that required insulin. and often what we call infants of diabetic mothers, which is a big category of problems that infants can have. These babies also have more respiratory distress that's out of proportion for their gestational age or their term aging. And so these are things that put this infant at risk for needing resuscitation after birth and having some of this delayed transitional physiology.
Colleen, earlier you mentioned something about kind of at a different minutes of life, the expected saturations. Mm-hmm. You know, I know we have ours kind of taped on our isolates, but for someone who maybe doesn't have that in front of them, kind of what saturations am I expecting from a newborn over the first few minutes?
Yeah, no, that's a wonderful question. That's something that we use on a daily basis and think about a lot, but most babies in utero, their saturation of oxygen is in the 60s. And so we have to remember that in utero, babies sat very differently than we do out in the real world. And it can take up to 10 minutes for an infant to transition and have saturations in the 90s as they're going through that physiologic changes and being exposed to more oxygen in kind of the ambient room environment. So I always kind of like to think about as I'm starting a resuscitation, where I start off, obviously what the heart rate is, but what are my saturations at that 2 or 3 minute mark? And I always just kind of think in my head, I should be in the 70s by 3 minutes of life. And that's usually because in the first minute, I'm trying to get the kid to the Ohio table. The second or third minute, I'm finally providing some support that's adequate. And I look up at that Apgar timer at around 3 minutes. And I should say, if I'm not close to the 70s, I need to think about what else needs to happen. Do I need to go through some corrective ventilatory steps that we call Mr. SOPA that we can talk about as well? Do I need to provide more pressure? Do I need to provide more FiO2? So the 3 minute mark in my head is always kind of my gauge of where I am. And then slowly from that 3 to 10 minute time frame of an infant's life, I'd like to see their saturation slowly improving, especially if I'm adequately ventilating them and getting good chest wall rise that's symmetric. So yeah, most resuscitation tables often cite the NRP saturation goals by minute. Yeah. Okay.
So if we go back to the case of Puppy, and you know, she's come out and she's initially apneic with no respiratory effort, and sort of we're doing all the things in terms of helping her breathe, but it doesn't seem to be going well. Can you tell me about this Mr. SOPA and sort of your practical experience as well with it?
For sure. So Mr. SOPA is an acronym that we use for these corrective steps to improve ventilation through positive pressure ventilation and also for CPAP. And so I'll just kind of start from the top and talk a little bit about what we use. Callie uses this on a daily basis as well. So the M in Mr. SOPA is the mask. And the first thing I think about is the size of the mask appropriate. Is it fitting over the nose and mouth appropriately? And I'm using those bony prominences of the face to apply pressure and get appropriate seal. I often think about too, when I think of the M in mask, I think about whether I need a second person to help me provide a really good mask seal. So occasionally we have babies who have a facial structure that's abnormal, or they're a late preterm infant and they're kind of between mask sizes. And I often think about if it's necessary to have someone hold the mask and someone else provide ventilation, either through the T-piece or through a flow inflating bag. So the mask is really important, making sure that mask is the right size and making sure that it's inflated and you get a good seal. The next part of Mr. SOPA, if all of that checks out, is repositioning the airway into that sniffing position. And that's just that subtle amount of head extension that allows the nose to be in that sniffing position where you feel like you're allowing the airway to be midline and open is most, the neonate's airway is more anterior. And so being in that sniffing position allows the airway to be the most patent and allows you to provide the pressure you're hoping to. S for Mr. SOPA is suction, and we always suction the mouth and then the nose with a suction catheter. You can use a bulb suction as well, and that's really just to help prevent any obstruction of secretions, meconium, blood, all the things that happen in delivery. O in Mr. SOPA is open the mouth. That's the one that people always feel like is like, what is the O? O is open. And I often stick my hand in there and move the tongue and make sure the mouth is really open. If it's that simple and I can just move a big tongue out of the way and have the mouth open to help contribute to good pressure and ventilation, that can make a difference. P in Mr. SOPA is adjusting the pressure to actually move the chest wall effectively. And we often adjust the pressure, which is called the peak inspiratory pressure. You often hear us call that as the PIP. And often we start that pressure at about 20 centimeters of water and increase that to 25 and sometimes above that if necessary to actually move the chest wall so that we know babies are actually getting appropriate inflation and ventilation. So that's the P. And then the A, the very last step in that acronym is an alternative airway. And that's when we're thinking about intubation with an endotracheal tube or potentially an LMA or a laryngeal mask that comes in a baby size, which is a size 1, that you can use in the setting of a baby that's very difficult to intubate or if you have just an inexperienced provider looking in the airway. So those are kind of some of our rescues at the end if all these corrective steps are not improving your ventilation. You know you're doing better from a ventilation standpoint. Again, if you have good symmetric chest wall rise, you have a rising heart rate, hopefully over 100, hopefully you're meeting those saturation goals by minute, and hopefully you're starting to see a baby who's going to spontaneously breathe and be angry at you that you were trying to breathe and hold a mask on their face. So those are some of the ways I think about Mr. SOPA and try to go through them serially in my mind so that I can decide whether or not I do need an alternative airway and think about intubation.
So one question I have is, are there any contraindications to using positive pressure ventilation, or are there any red flags while you're trying to ventilate that you're worried that you might be doing more damage by giving positive pressure ventilation?
Sure. We always have to be careful in a newborn about their change in lung compliance as we provide positive pressure ventilation. So many of us are familiar with pulmonary compliance, and that's really just a measure of how easily the lung can be stretched. And kind of a technical way to think about compliance is how much pressure do I need to attain a certain volume? And so the neonatology nerds always think about compliance as, you know, volume over pressure. If I can use less pressure to hit a set volume, my compliance is getting better. And so when we provide positive pressure, you have to be careful with that peak inspiratory pressure that you're not excessive. You don't ever want the chest wall to be bounding. You want good, symmetric, clear breath sounds. But excessive pressure can put you at risk for what we call an air leak, or a hole in the lung that creates a pneumothorax. So those are definitely things that iatrogenically we can cause if you're not cautious with your pressures and looking at the baby while you provide resuscitation. Yeah.
Colleen, for maybe a new intern or someone maybe intubating for the first time or intubating as something as small as a newborn, are there any pointers you might share? I know it's hard to kind of talk about intubating without being able to see kind of the picture, but what would you tell a learner if they're kind of trying to intubate for the first time and maybe how that might differ in a baby versus a bigger child?
Yeah, for sure. This is one of my favorite topics because when I work with fellows, many fellows have not had the experiences of intubation. And so my first thing I tell new fellows or new residents who are attempting something like this is to be in control. Be in control in a situation that is not always great. And you are going to become the head of bed and the intubator. So remember that preparation is really important so that you can be in control. Callie knows we always talk about having all the supplies you want at your disposal. There's a laundry list of things that you want to have available, your laryngoscope, your endotracheal tube, a stylet, suction, a CO2 catheter, a stethoscope, and also thinking about how deep you want that endotracheal tube is. So all those things in your mind you need to prep in order to be successful. And then the second thing I say is ideally have a great team around you who's experienced and can give you things that you need in real time. Callie's probably heard me before and said, when you're the intubator, you get to be the boss and you get to be bossy. And so when you are placing that laryngoscope in their mouth, I want you to be in a comfortable position. We do not squat when we intubate. Have the bed height where you would like it to be. Make sure that baby is in the midline and you feel like their anterior airway is optimized sometimes by putting a little shoulder roll or making sure someone helps hold their head in the midline for you. And I also like to make sure that when you're looking in the airway and you get that beautiful view of those vocal cords and the glottis right where you want to place that endotracheal tube, don't take your eyes off that midline position. Let your helpers bring your endotracheal tube, your suction, into your peripheral vision as you're trying to intubate. So those are some of the things that I find really helpful, and repetition and seeing that anatomy over and over again makes it much easier. But yeah, those are some of the positive things I can say, and it gets easier with time.
So before we get to intubation, as your one other technical question I have, you brought this up early on, is when you're giving positive pressure ventilation, it's been a while since I've gone to a newborn delivery, and you said something very specific about a T-piece. And so for some of our, I think most people can recognize or at least have an idea what, you know, a mask looks like. What's a T-piece, and why is it so important in this sort of the equipment that you need?
For sure, yeah. So a T-piece is kind of the generic way to describe what we from the American Academy of Pediatrics recommend as a standard resuscitation mask and pressure device. And so it looks somewhat like a T because the mask is like the lower area, and the upper component that it connects to, it looks like an upside down T, I should say. The upper component is where you provide pressure. And so that T-piece helps us consistently provide pressure that is consistent. So a T-piece obviously is connected to a mask, and on the top of that T-piece, if you occlude the port on the top of the T-piece, it provides your positive inspiratory pressure, or your PIP. And by holding a T-piece just in place with the mask over the nose and mouth, you are providing a consistent PEEP, or that CPAP. There's many different brands of a T-piece resuscitator, but ideally we like to use the T-piece because it provides consistent pressure each time you give a breath, instead of a flow inflating bag or an Ambu bag that varies depending on who's squeezing it, what their heart rate is, how stressed they are, what's going on in the room. So the T-piece resuscitator really allows us to have some safety mechanisms in place so that we're not giving excessive pressure to an infant during resuscitation. Yeah.
And so you're sort of doing like a BiPAP because you get both a PEEP and a PIP?
You do. Mm-hmm.
Very cool. I guess, Callie, do you want to take it on the rest of our case? Because I think we're doing okay right now, I think.
Okay, perfect. Poppy begins breathing on her own after about 2 minutes of PPV. She remains on CPAP for increased work of breathing. You trial her on room air around 20 minutes of life, but she continues grunting, and you decide to bring her to your specialty care center for continued CPAP. So, Colleen, when you trial Poppy on room air, what are you looking for to see if she can transition off respiratory support?
Yeah, absolutely. This is also a really common thing. We kind of try, or we call this our room air trial, because often we do want kids to transition and not come to the nursery and be separated from their parents. So this is a great thing for all of us to kind of understand. If you take a baby off respiratory support, you need to evaluate their work of breathing, which I'll touch on, their heart rate, and then their saturation. So the first thing I like to watch when I remove positive pressure is the work of breathing. And some of it is obvious, and some of it I'll talk about a little bit piece by piece. But first, I look for tachypnea, which is just a fast respiratory rate. So in a newborn, they can breathe a lot faster than the typical kid, and definitely faster than an adult. And so if they're breathing greater than 60 times a minute, that is tachypnea. We can see really severe tachypnea, but if you're consistently over 60, that's something you need to watch. The next piece that I like to make sure is I'm looking for nasal flaring. And so that's when babies open their nostrils and really try to increase their upper airway, increase the diameter of their upper airway so they can reduce airway resistance. So that's one sign of respiratory distress. Another would be retractions. Some of us see or are familiar with subcostal retractions below the rib cage, suprasternal retractions right above the sternum, obviously. And that's another compensatory mechanism that we use to help babies, that babies use with accessory muscle use. And that can be another sign of respiratory distress. One other thing that's kind of unique to babies is something called grunting. Some people describe this as singing. Sometimes you'll have your nurses say, oh yeah, that baby's really singing. That's not great. You don't want that. So grunting is an expiratory sound, often a prolonged expiratory phase sound that's caused by partial closure of the glottis. And babies do this very smartly to maintain their functional residual capacity. That's that volume that we all have in our lungs at the end of expiration. And they're really just trying to prevent alveolar collapse or lung collapse. And so they're partially closing their glottis and making this grunty sound during the expiratory phase. And it's important and it's physiologic, but that's again another symbol or sign, I should say, of respiratory distress. So if you're seeing tachypnea, nasal flaring, retractions, grunting, this baby is not doing well on room air. And these are all good indications to put that CPAP back on them and help them with that functional residual capacity, helping them maintain volumes at the end of expiration. So those are some of the things I'm looking for. Obviously, I want their heart rate to remain at a healthy level. Most of us say babies are anywhere from 120 to 160 on their heart rate if they're doing well. Many, many term babies are a little bit less than that when they're calm or sleeping, but ideally always over 100. And then you would like their saturations to meet those standards for the minute of life. And so if we're at 20 minutes or so out, ideally they're, you know, well into the 90s and not desaturating when you remove support. So those are some of the clinical signs and some of the metrics that you're looking for.
And in puppy's case, so you've taught us all about how sort of grunting is a sign of increased work of breathing in a neonate. And she, you know, failed her trial of room air and is needing further CPAP. So what are your thoughts about sort of what the differential is in terms of what's causing puppy to still need respiratory support?
Sure. So that's a great question and often a question that parents will ask when you place that CPAP back on. Usually a dad's like right behind your shoulder watching, you know, mom is anxious over there. She's trying to deliver the placenta and do all the normal things as her infant has a mask over her face. And so these are common conversations we have. And so after a C-section, as an infant of a diabetic mother, we know that she was at increased risk for needing some resuscitation and respiratory support. And so I like to share that with parents that we know that she had some baseline risk of needing help after delivery, and that CPAP is a very common thing we use after a scheduled C-section to allow babies to transition. We talk about trialing CPAP for several hours and to see if her work of breathing improves. She maintains saturations on low amounts of oxygen and really just giving her an observation period in your special care nursery or in your NICU to see what she requires. Many of us are very comfortable allowing these infants to have CPAP for, you know, 2 or 3 hours and seeing what her needs are, meaning what her oxygen requirement is, how does her work of breathing improve with prolonged positive pressure, and giving her some time to transition. And so I like to share some reassurance to parents that this is likely still transitional and that we are going to support her until she tells us that we no longer need to do that. I often invite parents to come with me and I talk about this as we set them up in a special care environment so that they feel like they're part of this process and they can see what I see. And I try to be very transparent with them and tell them, you know, this is mild, this is more severe, we're needing more support. It's an honor to take care of people's newborns. It's a really stressful, big life event. And I feel like those first few hours with parents are really critical. You have to build rapport with them. And so sharing some of the things that you're thinking and showing them what you mean by respiratory distress can go a long way.
Colleen, you talked about kind of respiratory distress and the things that we're looking for, but in this baby, so this like 39-week baby, could you talk a little bit about kind of what disease do you think she has? Like, how would you name this? And then what, you know, is there a point at which you expand that differential? Like, are you thinking about different things after some set period of time?
Absolutely. So a baby who presents like this at term, who has a history of being an infant of a diabetic mother with a scheduled C-section, most of the time these babies have transient tachypnea of the newborn, or what we call TTN. And this is, again, like it is described, transient. And that means that babies have retained fetal lung fluid that needs to slowly be excreted from the alveolar space intracellularly and then be reabsorbed into the pulmonary capillaries and lymphatic system. So often babies just need time and positive pressure to resorb that retained fetal lung fluid. And babies often with TTN have tachypnea. They may have a little grunting, but they usually do not have severe hypoxia or respiratory acidosis, any of the real severe things. This is usually something that can be resolved with just time. Often, if this is mild too, and babies have appropriate saturations, we can even let babies do skin-to-skin time with mom and resolve this if we think it's very mild and they have otherwise appropriate vital signs. So usually the first thing on my differential is thinking about this transient tachypnea of the newborn. You do have to think about respiratory distress syndrome, or what we call RDS. Infants of diabetic mothers, especially moms who had insulin, we know that they have a relative surfactant deficiency in their lungs, and we know that they're also more likely to have respiratory distress. And so that's also on your list. If this amount of respiratory distress persists, there's an oxygen requirement, there's any respiratory acidosis, you have to think about RDS even at term as an infant of a diabetic mother. Other things on the differential that we think about is a pneumothorax. We talked about that previously. You know, we've given some positive pressure to her. Let's make sure that breath sounds are symmetric, that we haven't iatrogenically caused an air leak where she's having distress in the setting of having a pneumothorax. So many of us, if they persist with respiratory distress, we'll get an x-ray and make sure that those lung fields do look appropriate. If things are persisting, we often are getting a capillary blood gas, and also thinking about the risk of infection. So neonatal pneumonias or neonatal sepsis. In Poppy's case, in this case, mom did have colonization with group B strep, but mom was not ruptured for a prolonged period of time. She had a scheduled C-section. And so, you know, her risk of infection is lower. But you do have to think about that as her respiratory distress persists. And so, you know, probably my top three are those things, or top four considerations in my differential are TTN, RDS, an air leak or a pneumothorax, and then thinking about infection. So those are things that we talk about with parents as well as time goes on. And usually as they pass the 6-hour mark, I start to think about, when do I need to do more? When is this not what I expected? And being a neonatologist, there's lots of things that sometimes you don't expect. But the 6-hour mark for me sometimes gives me impetus to move forward with more evaluation.
That was going to be my question, because I always feel like TTN is transient, but at the time it has to be like after the fact. Oh yeah, that was transient. It's finished. So if it continues to go, then it doesn't seem like at what point do I decide is this no longer transient? So it sounds like 6 hours at the very minimum from a duration standpoint is where you have concerns, but obviously other concerns like severe respiratory distress or severe hypoxia, things needing lots of oxygen support. Those are areas where you might be a little more aggressive. It sounds like getting an x-ray where you may be looking for pneumothorax or fluid. I guess the question is, for the chest x-ray, you can possibly still see a small amount of fluid in the lung fields, even with TTN, or would you not?
The characteristic finding on x-ray for TTN is that retained fetal lung fluid, or we call it fluid in the fissure, on that right fissure of the lung. And so that's really characteristic of TTN. Babies who are out on the floor that are healthy, that have never required resuscitation, probably have some fetal lung fluid still in their lungs too. And so understanding that it does take time, and transient tachypnea of the newborn can definitely persist past that 6-hour mark. We still occasionally see kids up to 24 hours of life that are mildly tachypneic and can have little bits of grunting. And usually those kids make their way into a special care nursery for monitoring if they're doing it out on the floor, just to be very cautious and conservative with newborns. So it's not to say that this isn't transient tachypnea of the newborn, but you have to start to broaden your differential and be thoughtful, because I always say you don't trust a newborn.
Colleen, you mentioned thinking about the risk of infection, and you talked about kind of that 6-hour mark. What is that kind of when you're thinking about doing a sepsis workup? Is that kind of 6-hour mark? Would you give a little bit longer? How do you kind of gauge that septic workup in a baby like this?
Yeah, there's lots of ways that the American Academy of Pediatrics and divisions of neonatology have looked at neonatal or early onset sepsis for many, many years. And one of the nicest things that's come out very recently is actually from Kaiser Permanente, and it's called the Early Onset Neonatal Sepsis Calculator. And it gives us a lot of great data because it helps us predict who is at risk for early onset sepsis. And so it's a free calculator. Anyone can, you know, Google this and find it easily. And you put in a set of maternal risk factors for this infant, and it can be used for any infant that's 34 weeks gestation or above. And it helps give you a probability of early onset sepsis depending on those risk factors and how the baby looks clinically. And I think that has really helped a lot of us have some clarity about how to perform your septic workup. So if an infant is, you know, obviously well appearing and has a low sepsis risk, it's really just clinical monitoring. They can remain on the floor. There's kids who are kind of in this equivocal zone who require some evaluation and monitoring. And this guideline really helps, or this calculator really helps you guide that. And then obviously babies who are critically ill, meaning they continue to need support outside of the delivery room, there's significant sepsis risk factors. Those are the kids that are getting a blood culture. They're obviously in a higher level of care for monitoring, and they're often getting empiric antibiotics as well. So there used to be a lot of style and feeling that used to go into early onset sepsis, and we're trying to be more evidence-based with maternal risk factors and a good clinical exam by someone who is experienced in newborns. So this early onset sepsis calculator is fabulous.
I have to say, as an intern, I found, you know, those calculators really, really helpful, especially on nights.
In a baby whose mom has been taking a medication like fluoxetine, like one that we categorize as an SSRI, sometimes there's chat about like delayed transitioning, maybe that affecting baby when they come out. Can you share a little bit about what you think about in a baby whose mom has been on an SSRI in those kind of first few minutes of life?
Yeah, absolutely. Many medical centers now recognize that this is a risk for neonatal apnea after birth if mom has been on a consistent dose of an SSRI. And so most medical centers have a pediatrician attend if a mom is taking an SSRI. And so we all show up for delivery. Many kids do well, but we definitely see infants with profound apnea right after birth. And they require that positive pressure ventilation. SSRIs can also cause changes in infants' tone that we see over time. And infants can even have prolonged kind of respiratory distress and irritability, sometimes with withdrawal from an SSRI. Those are more uncommon. Most of the time, we're most concerned about the respiratory depression or apnea right after birth. But if infants are not behaving the way you anticipate at term, really looking at mom's medication list and thinking about what they've been exposed to and what they no longer have is really important. And that helps us sometimes. So more and more women are treated throughout pregnancy with SSRIs, whether for anxiety or depression. And so it's something to really think about.
So I wanted to sort of bring you back to sort of the shoes of an intern. So, you know, going back to Puppy, she's doing totally fine now from a respiratory point of view, but you're a brand new intern and you get a call from the nurse that her glucose, her point of care glucose is 28. So can you take me through sort of what your first thought is and what is the definition of hyperglycemia in a newborn?
And that is such a hot question. And I love that you guys brought that up. And even within, you know, many senior pediatricians and neonatologists and endocrinologists, that true numerical value or definition of hypoglycemia varies. And so I'll talk a little bit about Poppy, and then we'll talk a little bit about what we anticipate for Poppy and a little bit of the symptomatology too. So many of you guys know that we should not be surprised that she has hypoglycemia or neonatal hypoglycemia as an infant of a diabetic mother. We often see this because in utero, these infants are exposed to higher levels of glucose that is coming from mom through the placenta. And they really appropriately upregulate and increase their insulin secretion in the setting of having exposure to high glucose. And so after birth, these poor babies still have upregulated insulin secretion. And all you know that insulin decreases our blood sugar. And so often during the first 24 hours of life, these infants have physiologic hypoglycemia because they don't have that consistent, beautiful, continuous source of glucose coming from mom. and they have to learn to adapt and downregulate their insulin secretion because your bolus fed or you're only fed, you know, in increments as an infant. And so it's a big adaption process that every single infant goes through, but the infants of diabetic mothers have more difficulty because we know they have relative hyperinsulinism because of what was going on during fetal life. So this low blood sugar, I believe, was 28. It's important when you see a baby with low blood sugar, and most people say in the first 4 hours of life, a blood sugar that's less than 40 is a critical blood sugar. We know that all babies, again, have some transitional hypoglycemia, but less than 40 is definitely something that should catch your attention in that first 4 hours, and you should look at this infant for symptomatology. Is this baby jittery? Is this baby irritable? Is this baby having trouble coordinating feeding or getting to breast? Sometimes they have, you know, those irritability symptoms on one end of the spectrum. Sometimes they present on the other end of the spectrum and are just sleepy or hard to arouse. And so there's lots of things that you can see in an infant that is hypoglycemic. And so making sure that you don't think this infant is also symptomatic. In this scenario, a baby who is 28 and has risk for continued hypoglycemia, these are babies that usually make their way to our special care nurseries or our NICUs for IV dextrose. And what I mean by that is we put in a little peripheral IV and we provide D10, dextrose-containing fluids, and give them a bolus and then start them on a maintenance dose of dextrose fluids to help them regulate their blood sugar. I think it's also important to note when you're treating babies with IV dextrose that anytime you give a bolus of dextrose, you are stimulating an insulin response. So be careful and think about what you're doing. Most of us will give, for this amount of hypoglycemia, give a bolus, which is that 2 mL/kg bolus, and then try to start that maintenance right away so that baby has a maintenance infusion going when that insulin surges just a little bit after your bolus. So in this scenario, it would not be surprising for her to need an IV for IV fluids. There's many other ways when babies have a level that is not quite as low to treat neonatal hypoglycemia. Something that was really a wonderful study is called the Sugar Baby Study. And this was done to help really limit the amount of infants that have to go to a special care environment for IV dextrose. We like to promote bonding with mom, early breastfeeding, and separating kids for hypoglycemia is just no fun for anyone. We know it's important for their brain to have appropriate glucose levels, but the Sugar Baby Studies showed us that in infants who are greater than 35 weeks, you can use 40% dextrose gel in association with any type of feed, a breastfeed, a formula feed, or even a small NG feed. So always associated with a feed to help them transition and recover their blood sugar. And so we typically allow infants to have that on the floor if they're not overly symptomatic and they don't have a critical value to recover with a good feed and a dextrose gel. And we always check, replete their blood sugar an hour after the feed is completed and see if they can recover. And ideally, again, I would love their recovery blood sugar to be over 40. So that's been kind of a well-studied way that we can help keep infants with their mothers if they have risk factors for hypoglycemia and treat that in real time. And it's been wonderful because it gives also nurses autonomy to look at a blood sugar and to quickly screen and treat. And so it's often a standard protocol for many, many hospitals to use oral dextrose gel. If a baby, again, wouldn't respond to that gel at that hour mark after the feed's completed, they're making their way into a special care environment for IV dextrose. So those are some of the big things that we do to treat kids who are at risk for hypoglycemia. We always try to make sure that they're feeding in the first hour of life if we can. And in Poppy's case, if she's on CPAP or requiring respiratory support, we're checking a blood sugar and either providing an NG feed or dextrose-containing fluids to help modulate her glucose levels.
So you mentioned that cutoff of 40 and the first 4 hours, then kind of where does your cutoff go if she stays in the specialty care center longer?
Sure, sure. So I like to see a baby after the four-hour mark have preprandial or before feeds their blood sugars be greater than 45 and obviously not symptomatic. That is still very physiologic for babies to have blood sugars in the upper 40s, low 50s in the first 48 hours of life. This is where you have lots of specialists kind of start to argue about glucose levels once you get closer to the 48-hour mark. So the American Academy of Pediatrics really is focused on transitional hypoglycemia in the first 48 hours of life. And the pediatric endocrinologists, or PES, or Pediatric Endocrinology Society, they're obviously worried about kids who have congenital or critical values past 48 hours of life who may have an underlying genetic or endocrine problem. So you will hear lots of people fight, academically fight a little bit about these glucose levels. But most of the time in the first 48 hours, if I don't feel like there's genetic risk or strong family history of hyperinsulinism, I really do try to allow babies in a normal nursery environment to just maintain 45 or above. And that is really appropriate. And I think that facilitates good bonding, hopefully development of breastfeeding, and us not over-medicalizing babies who are going through what every baby does, which is that physiologic transitional hypoglycemia. If you get past 48 hours and your blood sugars are consistently less than 50 or less than 45, you're going to have additional workup, which is probably a whole nother topic that I often get involved in in our medical center. And it's incredibly exciting and fascinating, but it's a different topic.
Thank you. Well, speaking of other etiologies sort of to think about with hyperglycemia, I know that in Puppy's case, you know, you sort of explained to us why her mom having diabetes predisposed her to have hyperglycemia. But I was wondering if you could touch on other factors that can cause hyperglycemia in term and near term infants and sort of anything that's management changing. I know that we were sort of talking about early onset sepsis before as well. Would a baby like Puppy having unstable glucoses make you think about that as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In sepsis, you could really have either extreme. You could have a baby who's stressed that actually has a high cortisol level and is hyperglycemic or potentially hypoglycemic. So those extremes in neonatal medicine are always like the things that catch our attention. Other things that cause you to be at risk for hypoglycemia are really anytime a baby has inadequate substrate for gluconeogenesis. So these are often kids who have low glycogen stores in their liver. And those are those small for gestational age infants, those kids that throughout pregnancy have been growing poorly. We call that intrauterine growth restriction. And once you're born, if you're less than the 10th percentile for your gestational age, we call them small for gestational age infants. So those kids are definitely at risk for just purely not having enough glycogen to tolerate a fast between feeds. And they get themselves in trouble. Other infants who are large for gestational age, meaning you're greater than the 90th percentile, are also at risk for having hypoglycemia. And it always makes me wonder a little bit if those kids are also infants of diabetic mothers that we just didn't know. But probably their physiologic mechanism for hypoglycemia is similar to an infant of a diabetic mother. Other children who have had a difficult delivery are what we call perinatal stress. A long, prolonged rupture of membranes, a long labor process. Those kids are definitely at risk for hypoglycemia. And then we briefly touched on kids who have genetic predispositions for hypoglycemia, specifically congenital hyperinsulinism, which is usually a gene mutation, growth hormone deficiency, a cortisol deficiency, or even inborn errors in metabolism, which, again, those are the much more rare reasons to be hypoglycemic, but you don't want to miss. So the differential is long, but specifically not missing the kids who are small, the kids who are big, infants of diabetic mothers. And then if there's any strong family history, you definitely want to know about those things.
Yeah, I remember back when I was a resident, we often as med peds, we often took care of also moms who were pregnant. And there was always the discussion of getting them off the SSRI and switching them to something safer. And I know nowadays we don't do that anymore. So I'm sure we're seeing many more moms on SSRIs.
Many of our moms, though, have trouble with that. Postpartum depression is real when your infant is sick. So, and if you've had postpartum depression before in a pregnancy, they really want to make sure mom's mental health is stable throughout the current pregnancy. So it's definitely something in our community that we see a lot. Yeah.
Thank you so much for spending this afternoon, this evening with us. I really appreciate you spending the time. You know, as I think about everything that happens with these babies, these newborns as they're born, how much some of the current chronic issues are with the mother are affecting sort of birth and afterbirth. I guess my one question I have is, you know, do we know much about like social determinants in terms of maybe some of our moms who are from sort of lower income homes or in different areas? Do we see how that affects the types of complications we may see in this newborn period?
Absolutely, yeah. Maternal health and access to good prenatal care is a huge determining factor for neonatal morbidity and mortality. We know, unfortunately, that infants of color often who have complications at birth have different outcomes than their white counterparts. And so that's something our division here in neonatology really is trying to be conscientious of and thinking about unconscious bias, thinking about lots of things that play into how we care for infants of color. And so actually, you know, nationally, this is a real problem. And so all the things, you know, start very early when we think about providing good access to prenatal care for all moms, making sure they have consistent transportation and mental health support throughout pregnancy so that they feel empowered to take good care of themselves because their health is directly related to their infants. And I would say as a neonatologist, you know, we see more and more complications throughout pregnancy in moms who are of lower socioeconomic status or of color. Yeah.
Do you have anything else you want to let our listening audience know? Otherwise, I might just ask you to give us some take-home points for our listeners.
Like I alluded to earlier, taking care of a family's newborn is like an incredible honor. Often people really remember you for years if you've taken care of their infant in those first few hours of life or potentially weeks in my job. And so being transparent and being open to them, I feel like really puts you in a comfortable place with a family early on. Understanding that transitional physiology is vital to taking good care of newborns and trying to limit the separation of infants and mothers or infants and families is one of the big things that I think we're doing better and better these days. We've talked a lot about respiratory physiology. We've talked about transient hypoglycemia. And those are really common things that we see in that first 48 hours of life. So if anything you take away from this is get an understanding of how life changes after you're born and how you can support a family when an infant doesn't do what's expected.
Awesome. Thank you again for spending time with us. This is such a core topic. I'm sure all our listeners will really love being able to hear everything you've had today. Thank you again. Maybe we should have you on because there seems to be many, many other topics in this area that we can definitely hit. So,
well, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me and have a great evening.
This has been another episode of The Cribsiders.
It's for the kids.
Get show notes and sign up for our weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. A special thanks to our producers for this episode, Callie Marshall, our showrunner, Sam Monsieur, and our wonderful social media team on Twitter and Instagram. I've been Jennifer Chisholm.
And I've been Callie Marshall.
And this has been Chris the Chi Manchu. Thank you and good night. And if you made it all the way to the end, here's a special treat, another poem written by AI. It's titled First Breaths and Sweet Bounce. In the nursery's gentle light, new lives begin their earthly flight. Some breathe with ease while others strain. Our vigilant eyes note each refrain. Rapid breaths, a moist sound heard. TTN's song like a fluttering bird. We watch and wait support with care as tiny lungs adapt to air. Oxygen flows a helping hand until the breathing storms disband. Hours pass, the challenge clears. Relieve sighs from staff and ears. But wait, another test arrives as glucose levels take their dives. Tremors, jitters, and hunger's cry. Swift action needed, do or die. Drops of gold from the mother's breast or formula, whichever's best. We feed with care, then check again to see if balance we attain. In warmth and love, we swaddle tight these precious bundles day and night. With gentle hands and watchful eyes, we nurture strength as each day flies. From respiratory woes to sugar lows, we face each challenge as it goes. In special care or standard room, we help these buds of life to bloom. See you guys.